بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam. Hello. Peace to you all, and welcome to another episode in this continuing series of The Names of God, episode 4, Ar-Rahman, the all-merciful, the infinite good. There are a variety of ways of thinking about how to define Ar-Rahman, which I think we'll be talking about in just a moment. It's great to have you back for this continuing series. I'm Adnan Hussein. And I'm delighted to be joined, as ever, with my colleague and co-host, Dr. Mark Applebaum. Mark, how are you doing?
Great. Excited to jump off the cliff again and see where we go.
Yeah, that's right. But at least we're into something where there are clear descriptors. But, you know, again, there's always wrinkles to these things. So we'll be talking about that. I mentioned that Ar-Rahman, which is, of course, one of the most frequently used and cited names of God in the Quran and in Muslim devotional circles. And it has this sort of preeminent place among the attributive names of God because of that frequency of use, but also because, as we noted in a previous episode when we were following At-Tilimsani's discussion, that there is an important Quranic verse that really establishes the importance or significance of Ar-Rahman as being a name of God, like Allah, that you can call upon God. In fact, you're in Surah Al-Isra, which is the 17th chapter of the Quran, verse 110, says, call upon God, call upon the infinitely good, whichever you call upon, either Allah or Ar-Rahman,
yeah,
to him belong the names most beautiful or the most beautiful names. So when we think about its significance and importance, it really can't be overemphasized. It really can't be underemphasized. I mean, so, you know, maybe we should start with just thinking about that word.
I mean, even before jumping in, I'll just add to that. Tlemcen tells us that Ar-Rahman is the only other name besides Allah that refers specifically to the divine essence. That's how he puts it. So great. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Relates to the divine essence and encompasses all the other names somehow.
Yeah, right. That's
this
right.
Is like one of the claims that he made when we were talking about Allah in our last episode. And also, I think it's worth noting that it's a kind of distinctive usage. You don't find it being used to describe human mercy. So we'll be talking in another episode down the line, the other name of God that is closely paired with Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, which comes from the same root, which we're going to discuss in a moment, which also might mean most compassionate or most merciful as well. That is an attribute in that adjectival form that can be used for human beings. But for some reason, which maybe we'll think about or explore, it is simply never applied as a descriptor of human beings. It is reserved very specifically only for calling upon the divine, just as the verse seemed to suggest. You can call upon Allah, you can call upon Ar-Rahman, because these are specific to and unique to the divine essence, as you were pointing out. So what does this word mean? And let's think about this interesting aspect that it is both functioning in some ways as a proper noun, a name, you know, in that kind of narrow sense upon which to call God and call upon God, and at the same time it does describe an attribute, a characteristic, a set of a quality, ar-Rahman. It comes from the root ar-Raham. Rahama is like many of the languages of the Near East, Semitic languages, Arabic, many Arabic words, most Arabic words derive from three-letter roots, as we maybe mentioned before. And this one, Rahama, Rahman and Rahim are both derived from this same root word.
Yeah, and the reference to the womb is right there, along with the root, if you want to talk a bit about that, because I think that it's so close to the span of this word, from its linguistic piece to how it's described by Ghazali and the Sufis, is vast. Everything from the origin of the individual human being, if we're thinking about womb, all of our origins, where, you know, the womb that we emerged from, that we were held in, to the giving birth, so to speak, of all of the cosmos through the Rahman, which is where we get to in Tlemcen. So,
right. Please. That's right. So it's kind of like the universe is a cosmic womb, as it were, in which existence and life, you know, is ushered forth, you know, from and is there. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, it refers to the specific, you know, womb. And so there is that kind of maternal component to the universe as a nurturing, fostering life with, and this is why it seemed that it was relationally important that all existent names, all the names that posit existence in some ways, according to Tlemcen, are connected with this Rahman, ar-Rahman, because of the way in which all existence is somehow partaking in mercy, in the fact of existence is seen as somehow mercy.
Mercy, compassion, tenderness, tenderhearted, these are all associations, right, with Rahman, with the word Rahman.
With Rahma, for mercy, which is kind of the verbal noun, not the description of an attribute, but that reminds me that if we're talking about this kind of cosmic sense, there are a couple of verses in the Quran that are relevant to this cosmic idea of mercy being written in somehow in the fabric of existence, particularly in the verses from, I think it's Surah Al-A'raf, the Heights, the sixth surah, verse 12, and then repeated again, verse 54, there is a very curious statement about Rahma, mercy, that relates to any of these two, you could say relates to any of these two names, Ar-Rahman and Rahim, but really signals in some ways to me the way in which it's coterminous with Allah, and maybe giving some sense of the logic of being able to call upon Ar-Rahman with Allah when praying to the divine or calling upon the divine. And that is that in two occasions, we're instructed in the Quran to say and to describe that God wrote upon himself mercy, kataba ala nafsihi ar-Rahma. And then in one case, it's kataba ar-Rabbuka, your Lord, wrote upon himself mercy. And the, you know, the sense that writing has in this is like the sort of a divine contract, you know, an obligation that you write down, obliging oneself, or it's so expressive of the divine's relationship to creation as a whole, mm-hmm. that mercy is authorized. And of course, theologically speaking, you know, these concepts about God are always, you know, about how God can't be constrained, right? And there are other names that would talk about the, you know, the might and the power and the sovereignty of God, that are about the limitlessness, about the lack of constraint, right? Mm-hmm. And yet here it is that the Quran in two places asserts that God has somehow obliged mercy as necessity upon himself. So that kind of suggests the priority in a way of this principle that mm-hmm. I think is quite, you know, quite powerful, this idea.
Yeah, and not to jump ahead too fast, but we might imagine, because I think what we're telling people, or what we're beginning to explore with our listeners, is how God could be understood or imagined, or the source of being could be imagined as infinitely merciful, compassionate, tender-hearted, even if we want to think about it that way. And looking around the world, the commitment to the Rahman that you're just mentioning, even in the Quranic context, we could imagine that as over and against the wrath, right? And so, or wrathful attributes of God or creation or being. And so his mercy exceeds his wrath, or his mercy is over and above his wrath, is theologically is going to be an idea that I imagine we're going to circle back around to more than once as we talk about the names.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we will have to, but it's great that you mentioned that, because that really refers to, I think, two variants of a hadith al-Qudsi, that is a prophetic statement that is voiced mm-hmm. as what God said, like right. Muhammad the prophet relates something that God said right. about himself. And yet this isn't in the Quran. It's like, right. You know, extra scriptural companion set of texts and reports, but it's voiced as what God says about himself. And there, I think, two versions of this, and I've seen them quoted somewhat differently in our texts. They're mm-hmm. very similar, but there's slight points of emphasis. But there's one hadith al-Qudsi that is about situating that after creation, you know, mm-hmm. after God was completed, you know, this creation of the universe, that he wrote in a book, in his book, meaning the, I don't know, it's kind of a curious phrase, kataba fi kitabihi ala nafsihi, so wrote in his book upon himself. So it's curious. It's a doubling of like where this is being written on. But this idea that there's a kind of, so I think what's suggested here is something like this archetypal preserved tablet that is mentioned, the Lawh right. al-Mahfuz, where kind of the words and the speech of God are written. And basically it's like, you know, all that has happened, all that will happen, all that is existing is all kind of in this one moment preserved on the tablet, right? And time unfolds, but it's already present in the divine presence on this preserved tablet, as it's called, Lawh al-Mahfuz. And that kind of idea of the book that God may have is sort of the decision, you might say, of creation and everything that's going to happen. And so it's this universal sort of sense that what is written there is somehow the divine decree, right, for existence. And he says, you know, that he said inna rahmati taghlibu ghadabi. So my mercy prevails, overcomes you know, my wrath. And in other versions, we have Rahmati sabakat ghadabi. It precedes my wrath, right? It comes before. And so there's interesting different resonances that that might mean, but both suggest priority in both senses of the word, right? Yeah. Coming before, but also being more important, having more significance, you know, over wrath.
And I think if I may, I think this is really important, you know, for some of you who are following along with us in our discussion of the names, you will already have a background in Islam, and this will be already very familiar, the language that we're using and the references to Quran and Hadith that we're using. And for those who may not be so familiar, you know, in a way, what we're painting a picture of right now is imagine yourself receiving this message that existence itself or creation has both of these elements in it, mercy and wrath. Whatever that means to you, where I'm not going to try to too tightly define, and like I said, I think we're going to be reflecting on this together, Adnan, throughout the names, that creation, meaning the world that you encounter every day, let's just start there, has elements of compassion, tenderness, and wrath in it. And which I imagine anyone, you could relate to this through your personal experience, encountering those things in the world. What we're referencing right now is a tradition, a whole host of traditions in Islam and Sufism, that circle around this idea that the mercy, which is part of the very creation of all of this cosmos, exceeds the wrathful aspect, no matter how much wrath we encounter. There's this claim. So even if we just hold it in that way, and I'm being a little phenomenological here by framing it this way, this is the picture that we're sort of circling around right now. So this is sort of like a little bit of a slight detour just to sort of frame it for those who may not be as much already in the language that we're using right now. So if you think about the mixture of encountering tenderness, nurturance, compassion in your life, as opposed to wrath, whatever wrath suggests to you, this is part of the territory that we're in about creation right now already, automatically, just by beginning to talk about Ar-Rahman.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe one reason why we may be emphasizing it so much, well, obviously it is emphasized in the tradition and in all the texts we're reading, and the incidence and frequency of Ar-Rahman is, you know, cannot be missed. I mean, it's so obvious. But I think, you know, one other kind of component is just thinking specifically about Islam as a religious tradition and how it's perceived and understood is so often it isn't associated in many people's minds in the West, in our audience, with kind of mercy and love. I mean, it is, you know, often characterized along with, you know, Judaism as a religion of the law. And so it's about the kind of framing and constraining of human behavior in society according to divine order and will is how you know, this is so often seen. Yeah. And this other component that is absolutely fundamental is very often de-emphasized in our perceptions and even, you know, in Muslims' own sense of the religion and how to practice it. It is so much about this sense of how do I act properly, right? And a sense that there's judgment around, you know, how committed I am to performing the good deeds and the worship that I should do and avoiding, you know, wrong behavior and so on, and thinking about it very much in those terms and being very present in one's mind. And of course, we will talk about all of these other attributes and names that do connect with divine, you know, lordship and sovereignty and and so forth. But to really realize how fundamental and what the implications of that are, of how fundamental Rahma is, and particularly Ar-Rahman as a unique descriptor or name for God is in the tradition. That's probably, for those who are less familiar with Islam, and even for Muslims who would know that intellectually, but to actually recognize and realize how significant and present mercy is in every component of existence.
Yeah, mercy and, you know, according to the Akbaris who we're talking about, mercy and love, mercy as love, as loving. And, you know, this is maybe a moment to share a very short passage of Ibn al-Arabi, because like you said, I mean, even if one is has a deep Islamic background, this particular source might be entirely new to you. And so let me just read briefly. This is Ibn al-Arabi, and in the among the Akbarians, Rahman, the dynamic outpouring of Rahman in creating the universe is called the Nafsa Rahman, so the breath of the merciful. This is the reason I'm going to read this. So Ibn al-Arabi wrote, the root of this breath, the Nafsa Rahman, is the property of love. Love has a movement within the lover, while breath is a movement of yearning, shauk, toward the object of love. And through that breathing, enjoyment is experienced. And God has said, as has been reported, I was a treasure, but was not known, so I loved to be known. Through this love, breathing takes place, so the breath becomes manifest. So this is gives you the flavor of the Rahman as a loving breath pouring out that gives being, according to the Akbaris, bestows being on every existent.
Wow, that is really beautiful and touching. And there's so many resonances also with the word nafs, you know, being both the self and the breath. And we had, you know, kataba ala nafsi, you know, nafsihi, you know, written upon himself, but what exactly? Maybe upon the breath of the merciful. Like there may be a reason why that formulation of the breath of the merciful, or I think Tlemcen put it, an-nafs ar-Rahmani, the merciful breath, the most merciful breath. So that's very hardwired in the unfolding of existence, this kind of sensibility. But I also think that that's so important. I think we've mentioned that, kunzun khafi, you know, as a hidden treasure, hadith al-Qudsi, that statement, again, a prophetic hadith, but it's a description about God's words about himself, about God's self, in that that is, may, in some sense, at the root of this whole project of the divine names is that, you know, there is a treasury to be discovered. And it's not just that we want to know it, but God wants to be known, right? Okay, so there's a dialectical kind of relationship somehow in this, in the fulfillment of the human is somehow coming to know this treasury that's hidden, right? Of course, to know oneself is to know one's Lord. So we know that that's also another one of these dicta that really grounds the project of the divine names that we're embarking on, is because how can we know what that treasure, that hidden treasure is? One way is, of course, to approach them through an understanding, an engagement, a reflection, our use of the 99 names. That would be mm-hmm. a kind of pathway mm-hmm. Into this. And that's, I guess you could say, one of the rationales for the 99 names as a road to travel, a spiritual path.
Sure. Yeah. And I think, again, like for those of our listeners who are not familiar with some of our references, this is a famous expression that Ibn Arabi loves to mention. It's disputed in terms of its origins, but for him, it's reliable that this hadith Qudsi, that meaning an expression in which, so to speak, God is talking and saying, "I was a hidden treasure and loved to be known, so I created a creation that I might be known." Some paraphrase, but that's fairly close. So again, the picture that's being painted in that tradition is that all of this that exists has been created for that purpose and out of that loving to be known.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm thinking maybe we should explore a little bit about how some of our commentators may have reflected on this attribute. And of course, we've been referring to the fact that they are very aware of the same verses from the Quran that establish Rahman as a name you can call upon God through, that it has unique characteristics that are like the name Allah. Mm-hmm. But just thinking of Al-Ghazali, he was very conscious that there might be different levels, because this idea of mercy, could be shared with human characteristics, and mm-hmm. How to think about that relationship between the two. He began with a kind of definition that suggests that there are two kinds of, that it's responding to need with a kind of desire to fulfill the needs of the other, right? The one who is really in need. And mm-hmm. these needs could be almost anything that we could imagine, right? Mm-hmm. And that there are two kinds. One is perfect rahmah, perfect mercy, which is pouring out goodness or benefaction and support to those in need. Mm-hmm. And then, which is, rahmat tamma, and inclusive or general mercy, which is rahmah amma, which is being this kind of generous, loving, and empathetic to deserving and undeserving alike, right? Is that that's not really the crucial question, is whether somebody is deserving or not, but having this kind of quality and characteristic. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because he wanted to distinguish between a kind of sense of altruism that might be in an empathetic being, mm-hmm. The desire to support and help others and meet their needs might possibly come from the feeling of wanting to relieve oneself of the discomfort of feeling the sadness or empathy for the other. And so to do something good might be, altruistic in this sense, but also be individually implicated, right? You might have a reason, which is a kind of interesting problematic that he's set up, is that, you might suffer from seeing others suffer, and to overcome that suffering, you might help others. And that is actually also to help yourself. And that was a very human component. That's the component at which the human exists. And perfect mercy was doing so almost in this objective sort of way that didn't partly, I think, because he didn't want to theologically incorporate an idea that God feels the pain of others suffering in an emotional sort of way. And, you know, so he was trying to think through that. And I think he suggested that there is a kind of like objective kind of perfect, this is the perfect mercy, is that it fulfills the needs without it being a problem that solves one's own suffering, that in seeing and in empathizing with others.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So for Ghazali then, does it seem to you that the reason the second one is more perfect, it's more complete, I guess?
Well, no, the first one was, well, yeah, I probably how did you put it? The orders, but yes, okay. You're right. The second is more complete.
Well, the one that is more complete doesn't even have a reference to one's own needs. It's just the acting out of
the principle of mercy, of expressing, you know, the willingness to do good, right? To be good without fulfilling any need that one has.
Yeah.
Or to relieve yourself of the suffering of witnessing others suffer, and by feeling that suffering.
So, is he critical of that then, or is it just that one is just a more direct manifestation of unconditioned mercy? Like, how do you see him as
hierarchizes them?
Yeah.
Other than to say that they are different levels, one is appropriate to the divine,
and the other
has a share, the human has more of a share in it. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Good. Yeah. So he cuts us a break then. So it's okay that to be human is to be involved.
Too. Huh? Yeah. Like, I mean, it's okay for us to feel better about doing good.
Well, another way to look at it, this is maybe a little more psychological, is that we're humanizing ourselves by being human in relation to each other. So it goes both ways at the same time. So this is why I was asking whether he seemed to rank them in a way that was, you know, skeptical, a little, took one down a notch, but I don't get it that way. It sounds really like he's granting, when we are nurturing or compassionate toward others, we're simultaneously fulfilling something in ourselves by being in relation to the other, is what that sounds like. Does that fit how you're reading him?
I think so. That's interesting. I mean, that's another kind of development on the point that I think he was making. What it made me think about with him was the idea that... Well, it related to a point I remember from in the Quran. There's a statement, a kind of prayerful statement, seeking for forgiveness, and it's situated with Adam and Hawa at the moment when they've transgressed the prohibition from eating from a fruit from a certain tree. And they're ashamed of this, and they seek forgiveness and turn to God as an example of pure tawbah, turning towards God in seeking forgiveness. And they say, Rabbana zalamna anfusana wa in lam taghfir lana lanakunanna min al-khasirin. Oh God, we have oppressed or wronged or harmed ourselves.
Yeah.
And if you don't forgive us, then we will be the losers, right? So there's some thing where like the transgression is not against God as like in point of fact it was the prohibition was made, but the actual reality of the experience of it for them as they express is that we have done something terrible to ourselves,
that's
spiritually damaging and dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we need to depend on God's mercy or on this kind of characteristic of mercy in order to repair that spiritual damage and harm.
Yeah.
Otherwise we will be in a state of loss. Like loss And that's also another kind of component of this, it seems to me, is that there's a lot of discussion about the absence. Maybe this is somewhere we could go about certain approaches psychologically to spiritual traditions, and in fact, specifically the divine names, the idea that the absence, you know, the soul is absent in this worldly condition, feels the absence of the divine, and therefore suffers, right, all of these issues or problems as a result. But that's not necessarily the only way to kind of think about this relationship, that it's also absence from oneself in
that's
some
right. sense. Yeah. It's both. And I think the psychological principle, if we want to put it that way, in there could be expressed like, if I withhold myself, if I'm locked inside of myself, if I withhold myself from relating in a compassionate way toward you, if I act just selfishly, impulsively, whatever it may be, I'm wronging both of us at the same time, actually. I mean, between us and our relationship, I'm doing you a disservice, right? I'm withholding something that in good faith as a human being, I ought to be there for you in that way. And I'm also damaging myself by reducing what I am as a human being.
Right.
Right. And in both of those things, I'm cutting myself off from my source. So if we want to think about the third in this relationship as the real or God or being, then if I'm locked into selfishly into myself, I'm cutting myself off from you and my actions in the world. I'm making myself more cut off as a human being, and I'm cutting myself off from transcendence and from my source that way at the same time. It's anti-relationship in both directions at the same time, you could say.
Well, this is really resonant for me of the fact that if we go back into the etymology of Raham and the root word, is that a number of variants or derivatives of that root, even in this kind of first form, not like elaborated form, but you know, the basic root is about propinquity, connection, and relation. And it's almost used as a, obviously because of the idea that those from the womb have connection and relation to one another in their origin, in their birth. And of course, that is a broader possibility and abstraction of connection and relation being established in the more cosmic kind of sense that we had been speaking about. So when you were talking about those sorts of relation, it seemed to come back to the very root of the name.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Closeness and distance. This is right there. And it's that language is throughout the Quran as well as Sufism, as we know. Like, am I distant? Am I cut off? Or am I seeking proximity, closeness? You know.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that itself also reminds me of another passage in this discussion that Al-Ghazali has in his book on the commentary on the meaning of the names, which was because he was distinguishing between these different levels or ways in which there might be an exclusively divine, divine sort of meaning of Ar-Rahman, and where the humans share in the name might come. And because he associates Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim, which we haven't discussed and we will discuss, but it's so intimately connected, he actually combines his discussion there together because they come from the same root word.
Right.
And they're also so closely connected in the formula at the beginning of all of the every passage or every chapter of the Quran, but one, which has the, you know, same phrase later in the chapter, but just not at the beginning, begins with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the most merciful, the most compassionate, or the most beneficent, the most merciful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and very often when they're translated into English, they're we find that they're almost synonyms, and some people prefer one to be the merciful and one to be, you know, the beneficent, but they're very close in meanings.
Yeah.
He combines his discussion of the two, but he does have an interesting passage where he tries to find what is the human share in this very uniquely divine, Ar-Rahman kind of name. And he says that the human share in the name Ar-Rahman is that the worshiper or servant or the human, right, show mercy to the ghafilin, the neglectful or the heedless, or we could even say forgetful, those who are in a state of lack of remembrance, lack of that real divine connection. And as a result, they behave or act in ways that are outside of that connection, and that you should have mercy, show mercy to them, by trying to call them back through exhortation, turn them back towards God, by way of gentleness and not by violence or force, but by way of gentleness. You should try and call them back and look at them with the eye of mercy, Ayn al-Rahman, and not of contempt.
Nice.
Because you have to understand and think about every insubordination to God's will or thing that puts you in conflict with the righteous sort of behavior in this world is your own misfortune. It is a misfortune for you. Mm. You should feel that these other somebody's insubordination, as it were, to God's will is a misfortune to you, and you should spare no effort to eliminate that to the extent that the person can be, you know, you, that your concern is that they might be exposed to God's wrath, right? And be, but even better, removed from proximity to him. Yeah. So just meant about proximity, because that is the truly awful state, is to be far. And the actions that you do, if they don't bring you towards God, but in fact actually take you away from God, that actually, just as Adam and Eve, you know, recognized in that Quranic verse, is a harm to themselves. And so the merciful of among the human beings, the Ar-Rahman characteristic, is when they take on that feeling of care and solicitude and mercy for others, that they not be deprived of nearness to God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a kind of divine, you could say. The reason why that's, I think, the way he talks about it is because that's sort of the place that the divine being or essence would have to the human. And so you, by being merciful in this way, are in some sense creating and inhabiting as a human being, the divine role of mercy to others in creation by being concerned about their relationship to God, i.e. their relationship to really fulfilling their spiritual. I thought that was just fascinating that he would think about it in that way. That the most transcendent, like we had when we were discussing the divine name Allah, I was quite surprised in our last episode when investigating this, that Al-Ghazali would actually talk about and discuss as a goal or as a realizable process to Allah, that is, you know, taking on in some sense the divine essence, right? It's like to try and embody in a way you know, the meaning of this most unique divine name, that there still was a human relationship to that, that wasn't, that got beyond the divide between the human and the divine in some respect. And it seems, again, here he's worked through some way of trying to explore how the human being can take on a Rahman. And in this case, it is by having the care and solicitude of the human's relationship to the divine and trying to be merciful and concerned about others, that they also have this proper relationship. It's, I think that's his sense of that.
Yeah. I mean, if we take seriously the idea of in the Abrahamic traditions of the human being created in a divine form, in the surah, then these, by getting into the names as we're starting to do with Rahman, somehow fulfilling as best we can that attribute would have to be essential to the greater completion of this life that we've got with each other, right? Because it's part of our template. I mean, if we take that, take this idea of being carrying a kind of a divine form, the Rahman, especially starting, you know, exactly where we did with that word and all the intimate meanings of being given birth to and everything that entails about the fragility of the human being and the need for nurturance and the need for mutuality. Well, we're right in the middle of basic ingredients for any kind of functional community right away. So yeah, I think nice to hear about a Ghazali in that light. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does raise a question though. So I don't know if now is the time to come to this. We alluded to the need to think about, to think about the tension of our lived experience with this idea of cosmic and divine, you know, mercy. You know, Al-Ghazali does define, you know, mercy as when you have the capacity to relieve the pain, the suffering, and fulfill the need of somebody in need, to do so is mercy, right? So if this isn't happening, how to understand this? So interesting.
Oh, and most of the time it's not. I mean, let's be honest. I think the problem of evil is, I think, what we're sneaking up on here, among other things, at least.
Yes, or you know, that's one way of framing it. Another way is how to explain the place of suffering in a world of mercy, right? If God is merciful, why would bad things happen to good people? Why is there suffering in the world by the innocents? I mean, this is such an obvious concern and question that we have to be asking you know, at this moment. And interestingly, it was also, of course, one that theologians typically, you know, asked as well as a problem. But I found the way it was discussed actually in Al-Ghazali very apposite to how, in trying to think about this question of Ar-Rahman, I kept feeling like, well, where is Ar-Rahman? I mean, right now, when I'm looking at what's happening in the world, it just seems so hard to see it as hardwired into the very nature of the universe. It seems like the nature of the universe is far more painful, brutal. There's evil. I mean, it just reminds me, of the like verse actually in Surah Baqarah again, you know, going back to this, I think this Adamic, you know, like, because we're talking about something core to the human. So
What is it about these human beings?
That's
so-called human beings. Let's put it that way.
That's right. Is that, you know, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, this famous verse in the second chapter of the, you know, the Quran, the cow, you know, that God says, you know, remember, well, actually it's remember, when your Lord said to the angels,
yeah,
I'm going to place a khalifa, a steward, a deputy, you know, somebody in a certain kind of authority on earth. And the angels, this when announced that this was the case, the angels reply and respond. They say, will you place in it someone who will spread corruption in the earth and shed blood while we glorify you and your praise you and proclaim your holiness?
Yeah.
You know, and I often, I've talked about this verse in the past, and I often think that maybe the angels were actually quite right about us. I mean, God's response to them is, I know what you do not know, or I know what you know not, right? But interestingly, so there was some purpose, right? There's some purpose that is to be fulfilled by the human being in this world, even though, in fact, actually, what we've done is spread actually quite a lot of corruption, pollution, chaos, disorder, shed blood. I mean, you know, and actually God doesn't deny that the angels are
right.
What the angels say will do, just right. Says, I know what you know not. And it's been a mystery to me always. What is it that one could know about us when we seem to lack the basic sense of mercy?
Well, in the I think you're right to point out that in the Quranic story, God does not respond by saying no, the humans aren't going to do that. That's not the response at all. Nor are we told what it is that he knows that that the angels don't know. It's left open, right?
Right.
And I think that, you know, at least there's this element, I think, both in Quran and in the Torah, that differently, there's a quite a dark picture that's embedded in both of those both stories. I went back to Genesis before we met today to find the line that's sometimes translated. This is right before the flood, right? Where in Genesis, again to paraphrase, God concludes that evil is the imagination of men's hearts. And in fact, even goes further, I think, in Genesis, God regrets having created the human being, according to that version. So it's a different story, but both allow for there being something at least heavy, and I would say tragic even, about what's the situation likely to be with these people, meaning us.
Yeah. I mean,
so lest anyone who's following this, we've been in some really lovely places today, but this is right. But this is not to convey that I'm tempted to bring Freud into this, but that would be a complete left turn. It not to convey that because we're speaking in a genuinely I'll say even reverential way about this tradition that we're inhabiting here, that we have a rosy picture.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
That's not where we're coming from. Yeah.
Right. Because I mean, this is the sort of time and experience, and you could choose almost any period of human history and say that this would be the predominant experience, is that it's life is hard. There's suffering, there's pain, there's evil. Yeah. There's, you know, injustice and oppression. You know, but of course, what we're experiencing and feeling, you know, right now in a very chaotic world, the Gaza genocide, you know, there's been so many times where I have thought, you know, where is the mercy? You know, can't there be some relief? And while we're right now in a moment at the time of recording when there's been a putative, you know, ceasefire, we know that the suffering really hasn't ended and the situation continues to be really terrible and awful. And it's so difficult to really see the mercy in the horrific actions that the angels rightly condemned us for playing out in front of us, and not, you know, even in a hidden way, that we're confronted by it all the time, very directly. Cannot be ignored or denied if you're at all open to what people are really experiencing in this world and in this life. And, you know, one component that I think is so fascinating to me in this is that from my distant position, feeling that empathy and that pain and wishing for mercy, feeling whatever I could do, I would for, you know, to help ease the suffering of others in such a way that sometimes it profoundly pushes you to question, how could this, you know, how could Rahman really be at the center of the universe when it's like this? And yet, you know, to see the Palestinians themselves be so firmly committed in many ways to faith, at least, you know, I know there's Christians as well as Muslims. And I think, you know, their, you know, Christian faith has been very important. I've been very, you know, impressed with the analysis and the kind of spiritual fortitude of somebody like Pastor Munder Ishaq, whose sermons and his comments have been so profound, insightful, and inspirational.
Yeah.
But I am very familiar also with, of course, the majority, especially in Gaza, of, you know, people who call upon, you know, that hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakil, you know, that their hands, you know, that it's in God's hands. And this kind of patient, I don't see them despairing. I don't see them saying, you know, where is God's mercy? I think maybe they might say, where are our allies, our fellow, you know, Muslims, but they don't feel that God has abandoned them. And to me, this is a total mystery, how one could go through such horrific suffering and feel like, no, you've not been abandoned by God. God is still merciful. And it just reminds me, like, you know, this passage here that Al-Ghazali, he typically, in each of his discussions of the names, he has this three-part structure where he discusses the name in its kind of definitional sense, then has implications, daqiqa, like subtle points, basically implications of the discussion about the definition, and then, you know, moves to another section called, you know, fa'ida, the benefit or lesson that one should take. So kind of now make it more personal for the seeker, like how would one really kind of benefit from the discussion that one is that he's had about the divine name, and then, you know, counsel, tanbih, counsel, how really then to act, you know, in light of it, right?
Yeah.
He's got structure typically. In this chapter, he adds another chapter where he says question and its answer, because the question comes to everyone's mind, it seems, and he's aware of this.
Right.
And it
says, right.
You might say, what does it mean for him, the Most High, to be merciful, Ar-Rahman, and to be the most merciful of those who are merciful, Arhamar Rahimin, which is a Quranic phrase. So the most merciful of those who are merciful.
Yeah.
For one who is merciful does not see people afflicted or injured, tormented or sick without hastening to remove that condition when he can do so.
Right.
But the Lord, praise be to him Most High, has the power to meet every affliction, to stave off every need and distress, to eliminate every sickness, and to remove every harm, even though he leaves his servants to be tried by disasters and hardships while the world is overflowing with disease, calamities, and tribulations, yet he is able to remove them all. You know, so it leaves the question, how can he be merciful in the face of all of this, with the capacity, you know, theologically speaking, the, you know, all powerful, the create the capacity. So in what sense can we understand mercy as operable in this scenario, which is the question we have?
Yeah. Both with respect to natural, so to speak, natural evils like disease or moral evils, ethical
That's
evils.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Where does he go with that?
Well, okay. This is what's kind of interesting is that, you know, it ends up being quite a long discussion on the problem of theodicy here, but in the frame of the question of mercy and the merciful, you know, he tries to argue that that there is no evil in existence which does not contain some good within it, and were that evil to be eliminated, the good within it would be nullified, and the final result could be an evil worse than the evil containing the good. And so the example that he gives is the case of gangrenous wound in the hand. Like amputation of the hand is pretty awful. It seems pretty evil to the one who's suffering it. Mm-hmm. But if it's done in order to preserve the body, because the gangrene would then spread and kill the whole person, then it is an evil with a good in it, that it is designed to achieve health. You know, it may not be the optimal situation, but if you have a gangrenous hand, you'd rather it be amputated so that you remain alive. So if the principle is health and the kind of suffering act of amputation is, you know, essentially secondary to the goal of achieving health for the whole body, then it can be acceptable and understood. And so he uses that as a kind of, you know, medical exam, you know, example to try and distinguish, you know, between what he says. And then he applies actually the dictum, my mercy precedes my anger, you know, is that, you know, if what is intended for its own sake, what is intended for its own sake takes precedent over that which is intended for the sake of the other. So in its own sake is health. And in this case, you know, amputation and the pain that it caused is secondarily undertaken, you know, for the sake of the other. So it's secondary. The main principle here is still that
I get it.
Preserve health.
Yeah. I think it's, does he go on to an interpersonal example? Because I think this is much, we're talking about social injustice or the brutality or mentioning earlier. I think it's harder. I think this is much harder to square.
It is.
And I mean, from one perspective, you know, if we go back to the angel's critique, it's like, if he knows something that they don't know, like it, let's say, well, it's still just us down here from one perspective, the freedom to make, to repeatedly make terrible choices as as masses of human beings, as human communities. Yeah, that seems to be what's, you know, we would have to frame that as what it makes possible is a human being who's capable of such repeated mistakes, travesties, inhumanities, that there's something growing in the midst of that, at least potentially, that mirrors the divine, and that by in those probably rare cases where we actualize that rahma in ourselves more full than not, that we both humanize and kind of so to speak deify ourselves, take more steps in that direction. But it's not a good bet. I mean, the you know, to go back to the angels and in the verse, it's definitely not a winning wager, as far as it seems to me, to bank on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's history. I mean, history falsifies.
Yeah,
I mean, and there's opportunities to see the good in history, but I think you have to you know, recognize that despite all other ways in which we frame the human condition as having encompassed progress, right? There's always this, like, sort of sense that human progress, right, has happened over history. And I think all they really mean is that there's been technological progress, because even in the age of democracy, the age of human rights, you know, all of these universalist sorts of principles and ideals that were supposed to mark kind of human cultural, philosophical, and moral development, right? I mean, you know, we still see that, in fact, the modern age is the one that has been most ruthlessly barbaric, violent, and destructive of both the world and the environment and of other human beings. I mean, every time that people talk about the medieval, a period that I study, it's usually characterized as violent and chaotic, and it is nothing like the level of barbarity of our own so-called enlightened age. So this kind of idea of our progress, I mean, on the one hand, I'm very committed to the idea that we have to be striving towards with greater knowledge, with greater, you know, capacities and capabilities of meeting the needs of people, that there should be this ideal of mercy, of rahmah, of achieving those. And yet we have created so much more suffering. It's so interesting because, again, I mean, this is really trespassing upon a Rahim in some ways. But because he combines his discussion, it's a very interesting way of trying to think of the two together. It does different inflections of this question of compassion and mercy as divine capacities, divine names, and how the human has a share in it. Mm-hmm. Says some very interesting things that I wish we would take on board now. I mean, this is quite stunning to me. He says the human's share, the worshiper's share in a Rahim, the, you know, maybe we could say the most compassionate, is how one way to translate that divine name, lies in not turning away from any needy persons without meeting their needs to the extent of one's ability, nor turning from any poor in one's neighborhood or town without committing himself to them and ridding them of their poverty, either from his own wealth or reputation, which is an odd sort of notion, but either from his own wealth or reputation, or by interceding on their behalf with another. And if he is unable to do all that, he should assist them by prayer or by showing grief on account of their need in sympathy and love towards them, as though he were thereby sharing in their misfortune and their need. Yeah. I mean, this is a social vision of that emotional quality.
Yeah.
And to think that this is written, you know, in the 11th century of the Common Era, 11th or 12th century, I can't remember the exact date of it, but we're still nowhere near this kind of ideal, you know, even though we now actually have the capacity in ways that were unfathomable at the time Al-Ghazali was writing.
But we're not much further from our pre-human ancestors. I was going to say monkeys, but that, I mean, you know, we're not much further evolutionarily. We're a fraction of a second on the span, in the span of history, further along.
That's one kind of way people look at it. But I mean, I think one issue is that culture is supposed to be a major factor in overcoming the pure biological, right? Like, culture is supposed to be something that distinguishes human social development, you know? And yet, despite the fact that culture has changed a lot in terms of the values, social structures are very different from they were, say, in, you know, Mediterranean societies 1,000 years ago, you would think that with all those differences that are kind of the ground, the social and cultural ground upon which unique features of human experience would develop, that we would be in a very different sort of place.
Well, I mean, you're tempting me to bring Freud in. I'm telling you, it's civilization and its discontents. It's such a dark and funny, but dark view. But I think, I mean, someone who was with us at the beginning of this hour and with the Nafs ar-Rahman might, you know, the outpouring of the breath of the merciful, and has followed us to this point in the conversation, which is touching on real, I'm just going to say despair about the human condition, at least the availability to be in touch with despair about the human condition around us, might be surprised at like how we got here, or was that what you guys were here to talk about? And I would say yes, because the range, I think what you and I are trying to model is the interrelatedness of all these levels of being and relating to the various traditions that we inhabit together. I don't feel like we can leave any of it out. And that's sort of a word to anyone who may feel like, how did you get here?
You get here for mercy. Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's the perceived absence of it. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Thing I did want to,
the evident absence of it. Yeah.
And you might have some further thoughts about how to think about that on like the more psychological level as well. But at this theological level, Al-Ghazali really ends on a very optimistic. I mean, he's quite optimistic. I mean, he thinks the majority may not really understand. And you always have that kind of elite kind of sensibility that not everyone is going to, you know.
This is another third rail, I suppose,
It allows him to sort of conclude on a positive note, because he says basically, you know, you have to question your reasoning here. That there's two things that you could consider. If a particular evil occurs to you without your seeing any good beneath it, you should think it possible that a particular good be achieved without its being contained in evil. You should query whether your reasoning might not be deficient in each of these two trains of thought. And he goes through both of them. And one of them, you know, after kind of discussing them, he says, accuse your reasoning in both these ways and never doubt that he is the most merciful of the merciful, or that his mercy takes precedence over his anger. And never doubt that the one who intends evil for the sake of evil and not for the sake of good is undeserving of the name of mercy. Mm-hmm. Beneath all this lies a secret whose divulgence, the sharh, you know, that is the revealed law, the shara, prohibits. So be content with prayer and do not expect that it will be disclosed, right? You may not know. So it's again the same, you know, God knows what you know not, but you should really have faith. If you're really following this path, you will have faith that God really still is the merciful, you know, the most merciful.
Yeah.
You have been instructed by signs and given directions. So if you're worthy of them, then ponder them. And he quotes a line of poetry. You would have been heard were you calling a living person, but there is no life in the one you call. Meaning that the majority won't, you know, necessarily understand this. This is the condition of the majority. But I do not think that you, my brother, speaking to the person, you know, who requested the book, you know. Is intended, lack the capacity to ponder the secret of God, great and glorious in the divine decree. So all these hints and notices are unnecessary for you.
I think I think there's so many big questions that we're touching on, and we'll probably continue to circle around as we continue with the names, Adnan.
Yeah.
One of them is about that kind of counsel, which in a medieval text makes complete sense to me that would be the case. Just trust. You know, have faith. And I'm not being dismissive of that, but I think because it was, I think, to be maybe more generous, it was trust, but also reflect. So, I mean, the reflection is certainly not lacking from that call. But, you know, for someone, and there may well be people who are following along with us here for whom that's the right framework, like that, like the framework of iman, or the framework of trusting deeply, is already by itself sufficient as an answer. For others, the trust would be, okay, trust, but trust and reflect and look and see, like what do you, you know, and somewhere we could go, and maybe we may end up continuing with the same name, is reflecting on the wide range, the continuum of suffering and evils that any one of us could experience. Because one could ask the question, you know, we've gone to some kind of the more, we've alluded to the extremes, but we could also ask questions about the relative evils or the relative suffering that any one of us would have undergone, and ask the question about those, is there mercy in it? And I think that's worth maybe another whole conversation, because I think that it's so rich. Both, it's rich theologically, it's also rich just purely existentially. And phenomenologically, to ask the question about suffering or being the victim of real evil, I think it's worth like continuing the conversation in that direction as well. I guess what I'm getting at is that I think like I would not be satisfied with either a purely theological prescription for this, or a sort of, I don't know, a dryly psychological or philosophical one that still didn't speak to lived experience in a way that
right.
was open to transcendence. But I think what I feel like we've broken through to in this conversation is now we're getting into the names that really touch directly on human experience and the lack of experience of certain things, or the almost total absence of certain things in everyday life. So I think we're really getting into rich territory now.
I agree. I mean, I think we raised sort of the big ultimate and extreme, as you're pointing out, conditions, but there's so much textured experience to explore.
Yeah.
Between the kind of extreme or in this kind of ultimate sorts of cases. But I think I would be very interested to consider how one might actually see mercy accountable sort of daily sorts of experiences as well, right? You know, I mean, it's possible to ask these ultimate questions when you're dealing with cataclysmic tragedy. And that's, you know, useful for reflecting on ultimate concerns. But also we have to think how daily life, it's just, you know, right now, daily life, difficult to separate from cataclysm and chaos around, but you know, the way we experience these things is still through the mediated way in which we live, right? So we don't live the kind of abstract news and so forth all the time. Like there might be parts of our consciousness that will engage that, but at other times, we're still sort of struggling, it seems to me, to really see where in oneself you would find that quality of mercy operating in an effective sort of way.
Well, right. And I mean, I think the way a phenomenological psychologist might ask this question would be something like, have you ever had an experience of being shaken to the core in what was a terrible way, physically, emotionally, and whatever the way that way is, that later you were grateful for. Mm-hmm. That later you experienced as something that gave you something precious.
Right.
I mean, that would be one way of framing the question. Certainly not the only way, but that's one way to invite you and me, and our listeners to sort of think about what we're raising about suffering and mercy.
Yeah. And I think maybe also
in the first person, personally.
That's right. Yeah. And also just to connect it to Tlemcen as we maybe conclude our conversation is also with his kind of sense of expansion and contraction, right?
That's
just these natural cycles that we go through, periods of real bestowal of, generous and mercy, to others, and then others of this kind of contraction where you're really left with yourself in a spirit of loss or lack or absence, and how to deal with that and remember that there is this cycle somehow.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, an Islamic reference to this would be Surat-Tin, for example.
Oh.
So, and we might come to that next time, but I mean the idea of the human being being created in a great or the best form,
right?
But then being reduced,
Ahsani Taqwim, and then but falling to Asfala Safilin, the lowest of the low.
Yeah, and this is their. I'm just sort of sticking with the Abrahamic traditions today, but it's there. That's there one way or another in all three of the Abrahamic traditions. This idea of just how low, what we are. Like, what are we?
I think there will be a chance to kind of come back and circle back to some of these in our next episode that might be a Rahman and Rahim companion, as we move forward into Rahim, but still thinking about the same topics and issues because they're very closely connected while exploring some of the specificities of Rahim, Ar-Rahim. I think that will...
Sure.
Be useful. Yeah, that will be useful.
I would find it, and I have already found it, so useful when viewers share comments about where this is landing or not landing. I think we always appreciate that. And, obviously we have a very particular sort of mission that's in doing this that doesn't capture every possible way of approaching the topic. We could be much, much more systematic than we are, but I think this is a very existential and personal dialogue at the same time. So let us know how we're reaching you or not.
That would be helpful to know. I mean, we do appreciate all of the comments, engagement, and interaction. So do put them in comments in the YouTube video. I don't know if you can leave comments on a podcast. I think not with the audio form, but you can in YouTube. And
yeah.
You check them and read them, and we appreciate them so much. And, listeners and watchers, it's a journey. I hope you're finding your pathway with us. And it won't always coincide and be exactly the same path. And in fact, actually, we're going with the flow. The structure we have is we'll talk about the names. But beyond that, a lot of productive new things happen experientially, which is the approach we want to take in general to thinking about the names, but also in our own elaboration and discussion of them together with you. So we hope to hear from you, and we look forward to speaking with you, for you, together, Mark and I, in our next episode next month. But until then, we wish you peace with justice and solidarity. Salam, everyone.